Warning. Warning. This show contains mature content. Listener discretion is advised.
Are you ready to get your mind blown?
One angry New York City Puerto Rican decided to start a radio show, determined to piss the world off by shoving a mirror in front of society's face. He kicked them in the balls.
What are you? Who are you?
This is the Crotch Shot Radio Show. Crotch Shot Radio Show.
This is not a test. This is a broadcast transmission.
We're going to stay on the air.
And now, the Whippy. The Whippy.
Welcome to the Crotch Shot Radio Show, where we kick the issues in the balls. We're on an active war against bullshit. We will do anything and everything to expose bullshit. The ends sometimes justify the means. So if you're angry and want the tooth exposed, then strap in and prepare to be shocked. This is Smash Mouth Talk. If you can't accept that, then fuck off. I'm your host, Louis B. I takes no shit from nobody. I actually expose the bullshit of society and chop it up into easy-to-digest chunks for you. Today will not be any different. Today, I am honored to have a libertarian candidate for comptroller of New York City, Mr. Alejandro Merced. Alex, how you doing?
Doing good. How you doing? How's everything?
I can't complain. You know, it was a beautiful day in New York City. A little rain, and then it just warmed right up. As my grandmother would say, you know, cogiendo color, catching some color from the sun.
See, I am very glad it's overdue.
Yeah. So, yeah, well, by the way, you speak some Spanish, and, you know, I know I said this isn't, it wasn't important, but you are Puerto Rican.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yes, I am.
By state law, I have to do this.
Okay.
Puerto Rico.
Toma.
So yeah. Oh man, I have no choice in the matter.
It's okay. I get it. It's all good.
Yeah. So let's just jump right into this. You know, you ran for Senate back in 2016.
Yep.
I did vote for you.
Thank you.
I did vote for you. I whenever there's a libertarian candidate, I vote straight down.
Perfect.
You know, unfortunately, obviously, you didn't make it because why do you feel, well, first question, why do you feel New York State is not ready for libertarianism?
I don't think that it's not ready for libertarianism. I mean, I felt like I got a pretty good response when I was traveling the state last year,
mm-hmm.
but libertarianism is just starting to really kind of get into sort of the public consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in a very progressive leaning state like New York, there's just basically a lot of, there's a discussion that needs to be had. It's being had. I mean, I have, my vote total last year was around 48,000 votes, which makes me the third highest vote total for a libertarian in New York history. Behind, number one was Norma Segal in 1992. Number two was Warren Redlick in 2010. And again, that's high. Those are highest vote totals outside of president, because president's a different story.
Yeah.
But bottom line is, for a party to win, because again, there's the argument for libertarianism, which I think is growing in New York and in other places.
Mm-hmm.
New York, we got a lot of room for growth because it's a tough state for libertarians. But the Libertarian Party, for it to grow, what you need to be able to do is you need to be able to run candidates all across the ballot. Because
right.
what happens, like as a U.S. Senate candidate last year, the areas where I did better were areas where we had down ballot candidates running for state legislature or other offices.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that right now the Libertarian Party isn't an official party in New York.
Oh.
So we have to collect a lot of signatures to get on the ballot, which is really expensive. I mean, we spent mm-hmm. around $70,000 to get me and Gary Johnson on the ballot in New York last year.
Right.
And that's a lot of money. So what happens is that we can't run as many candidates as we like. And most voters, they just pick a party. They don't even care. Like, most people didn't even realize there was a U.S. Senate race last year.
Mm.
They just pick their party and they vote all the way down.
Right.
So to get people to vote Libertarian as a habit, they have to be able to vote all the way down. We need to be able to run candidates for every other office. That's why 2018 is such a big year. Because
mm.
if the Libertarian Party gets 50,000 votes in 2018, then we are an official party for the next 4 years, which means we could run candidates for every office without any kind of challenges. Because right now, when we do try to run down ballot candidates, because we had a whole bunch of candidates last year, but a lot of them, once they got their signatures, Republicans and Democrats challenged their signatures and had them removed from the ballot.
Wow.
So if we can get that 50,000 votes in 2018, that's really the next big step. And then after that, really, that opens the doors. Because if we can run lots of candidates everywhere, then you have all sorts of libertarians all across the state walking around talking to people about libertarianism.
Right.
Because it's a lot different when it's a candidate reaching out to people
mm-hmm.
than it's just people reaching out to people. For some reason, when you're a candidate, it's just people just listen more.
Yeah, I really do believe it was Ron Paul that really kind of got the ball rolling, if you think about mm-hmm. it. I mean, that's what got me. I mean,
same here.
Listening to Ron Paul is like, it made the most sense. Like that like, limited government, leave me alone, let me make my money. And I mean, look, I I've spoken about this on the show before. Yeah, if New York became a totally libertarian state, yeah, for I guess the first few years things will be hard. People will have, you know, but the opportunity will finally be opened up. I mean, is that an issue? People are too in love with their entitlements.
Basically, people are going to, at the end of the day, vote in their self-interest,
mm-hmm.
which is rational. I mean, we expect all people to act sort of in their rational self-interest. So when there are government programs in place that benefit someone, it's in their rational self-interest, unless they feel like it's in their rational self-interest to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the libertarian message, we spend a lot of time talking about the problem. We say, okay, the government causes this problem, And all people hear is, oh, more problems. I mean, last thing, people don't like people who just sit there and highlight more problems in your life. You're saying, okay, I already know I got all these problems. Now you're telling me I got more. People want to hear people with solutions. And that's what us libertarians need to spend more time focusing on. What is the solutions? So what I like to always focus on is, instead of saying, okay, government causes this problem, which is all true,
mm-hmm.
I like to focus on saying, hey, you know what? We can solve these problems today. Instead of waiting around for government and waiting for political solutions, because even if you think a political solution will work, it takes election cycles,
right.
which means you're talking about decades, and then the end result will be a watered-down version of what you were working for in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But you can get together with some friends, start a business, start a charity, start a community organization that requires no government, is just you reaching out to other people, communicating them the value of making actual change, and you can make that change on your terms today. So the idea is we can inspire people to ask to take that power back, that power to change the world around them, then essentially the demand for government will naturally disappear and government will shrink. But until we inspire people to take back that power, what's going to happen is that the other parties are just going to keep scaring people, telling them how the world's a scary place that will only feel less scary if you allow government to take more and more control of your life. So we need to inspire, because we have our work cut out for us, because we're asking people to take responsibility over their lives. We're asking
right.
people to take back power. That requires inspiration, not fear. Fear is a much easier thing to give people, but fear is something you use when you're trying to take power from someone, and that's not what we're doing. So it's a much harder argument that we're trying to make, but it's the right argument.
All right, let me just go with this question because I forgot the question I was going to ask. You would think that, you know, if someone is in a constant state of fear, I mean, most people would get upset and tired of being afraid. Why are people so comfortable allowing the government, like, oh yeah, the government should do this. The government, like with Democrats, it's like they're charitable with other people's stuff.
Oh, agreed. The problem is people need to know what the solution looks like and believe that the solution works.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times, like, again, libertarians talk about how, well, if we got government out of the way, businesses would do X, charities would do Y. But you know what? If we really want to push that argument forward, libertarians need to get together and start those charities, start those businesses now, not wait till government gets moved out of the way. A lot of libertarians are. I mean, you see libertarians involved in the Seasteading Institute, the Liberland Initiative, the Bitcoin stuff. Mm-hmm. That technology is really changing the ability for people to operate outside of a lot of the regulations, the taxation that really makes it hard for people to do business. It's literally saving lives in Venezuela, because in Venezuela, basically, they just keep printing money and making the money more worthless. But Bitcoin has actually allowed people to generate money, and actually money that actually holds value. So technology and businesses and innovation are the way, and we need to focus on that. But we need to make... We need to really make examples and be the example of the solution we're talking about. So create those charities so that we can say, see, there are charities. I mean, I know there's charities that exist, but we need to create more examples of what our solutions look like so that way we can be like, see, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And then people will go, you know what? You're right. That works.
Yeah. I read an article about Venezuela and Bitcoin that people are actually like, they're making these cards. And they're exchanging those cards that represent the actual Bitcoin, and they're worth more than the money, because it's not like it's a fiat currency; it's actually backed by Bitcoin.
That's awesome! I didn't realize they created money substitutes. Okay, cool. I mean, yeah, it's really interesting what's going on in Venezuela. So, for those who aren't familiar with the whole story, what happens is that in Venezuela, the government subsidizes electricity, and basically people don't pay their electric bill because the government decides to just make it a right like everything else, part of the reason why Venezuela is in such bad shape right now. Mm. But people have taken advantage of that and being able to set up Bitcoin mining computers, because one of the big costs with mining Bitcoins is electricity. So if the electricity is free, you get rid of that cost, and that's allowed people to create currency that has saved them from the inflation that's going on in Venezuela for some people, and allow them to survive at least.
Yeah, they're trading rare Pepe the Frog cards.
That's
yeah. This is from Crypto Insider. These Venezuelan developers are using Bitcoin and rare Pepes to fight against a dismal economy. So
that's great.
So Pepe the Frog to the rescue yet again.
Oh, 4chan.
Oh, my stars. Those lads, they do the Lord's work.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Did you go to the He Will Not Divide Us cam when he had it up?
No, I don't. I mean, is that the like that 24-hour camera installation they installed and people were like trolling it?
Oh yeah, it was so fantastic how he got trolled, and then he had to the Museum of Moving Image shut it down. They moved it to like New Mexico, and you know, that got trolled and they shut it down, and then he's like, he put like a camera on a flag that was supposed to last, and 4chan using weaponized autism to figure out where this flag was using ancient star mapping techniques, and they stole the flag, and now it's now he has it overseas.
Gotcha.
So
yeah, no, I didn't follow that too closely, but yeah, no, I was kind of familiar with the situation.
Yeah, it was hilarious. But I mean, why do you feel people just don't want to take responsibility for their own communities?
I don't think it's that people don't want to take responsibility, is that they can't anymore. The government has printed money, the government has taxed, the government has regulated, and that's increased the cost of living. I mean, take a look at New York. It's impossible to, like, pay for rent, pay for food here. So then what happens is that people find themselves working 24/7 just to get by. So they have no time to volunteer. They have no extra money to donate to charity. Right. If you reduce the regulations, you reduce the taxation, you free up some of the people's disposable incomes, plus the price effects that would, people would have extra money. And instead of maybe working the extra hours, they'll have extra time which they could donate to their communities or spend with their children, spend with all those things. Government's crowding out people's time.
But Alex, without all those regulations, I won't have clean water or clean air.
You know, a lot of the improvements in the environment have been done more due to technology and innovation. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, any business that might generate some pollution, they don't do it for the sake of generating pollution. It's like, reminds me of the old Captain America cartoons where basically you see the villains and their sole purpose, all they wanted was to pollute. And it was just sort of like this weird exaggeration of like corporate America. It's like, ooh, we get to put oil in the river. Yay. And it's like, that's not what happens. Like some businesses, people are dealing with the technology that's there now. Technology gets better and people are going to embrace newer technology because generally it's more efficient, and generally more efficient technology is better for the environment. So there's a natural economic incentive to become environmentally friendly over time as the technology develops. But also on the regulation front is people don't realize that regulation makes things worse, because what happens is that regulation becomes more complicated and complicated and complicated. And when you have complexity, it means it's harder to keep track of who's following the rules, meaning it makes it easier to cheat. Like, I always use the analogy of Uno. You've played Uno before, right?
Yeah.
I love Uno.
Yeah.
I mean, but the thing is that the rules for Uno are simple. Mm-hmm. Anybody can figure out Uno. So you don't need a referee. You don't need, like, a government to tell you who's cheating at Uno.
No.
Someone puts a red 2 on a green 4. I'm like, no, 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 no.
Yeah.
That's cheating. So that's why you want simple rules. So instead of, you know, a lot of times instead of saying I want a small government, I say I want a simple government. Because even if people can't get behind the idea of small, they can get behind the idea of simple. They can get behind the idea that government shouldn't be so complicated that you don't know who's following the rules and who's cheating and who isn't.
Exactly.
Because right now the government you have, the rules are so complicated, the stacks of rules, I mean, just like you, like any one rule regulation is bigger than the Constitution. And basically, it makes it impossible. You need a team of lawyers, a team of accountants to figure out anything. So people are frozen. If you want to start a business, people don't have the money just to have the lawyers and accountants just to consider it anymore. So people don't start a business.
So what is the biggest – I mean, why – oh, goodness, I can't talk today.
It's all good.
Yeah. Like, let's talk about the New York State's economy. Like – It always baffles me, or upsets me that, like, let's say when it comes to the New York City subway system, I have a friend who works for the MTA, and the way he explained it to me was the MTA does not get to keep the monies that they make from, you know, selling MetroCards, fares, and tolls and whatnot. That goes upstate, and they get back only a portion.
Yep.
And with that portion, they have to pay their workers. They have to pay for improvements. Why is it that New York City is always getting screwed over by New York State?
It's just the nature of the beast and how a lot of this stuff was set up a long time ago. And that's why it's important to get, like, New York State legislators who understand these things, and also people in city council, because it's New York City, New York State, and I think there's even some other authorities that are outside of New York State that have some say in all of this, in the MTA and the MTA board. But it's not just that. I mean, there's also the Tappan Zee Bridge. The Tappan Zee Bridge is built on the widest part of the river. Now, generally, when you build the bridge, you build it on the narrowest part of the river. Why? Because then you spend less money building the bridge, and the bridge requires less maintenance costs. That's better for taxpayers and better for people who have to drive the bridge and have to waste less gas.
Right.
But they built it on the widest part of the river because of taxation, because of who would receive the taxes. So the only way for the authority who built it to receive the money from the bridge, they had to build it where they built it. And that means the Tappan Zee Bridge costs a lot more money to maintain. You waste more gas going over it. It's, you know, the problem a lot of times is like a lot of these jurisdictional issues that cause a lot of problems. But that's the And that those are difficult issues to work out, which is, again, why you need people with good head on their shoulders being voted on, instead of a lot of the people you have nowadays who just think of state legislature or city council as a stepping stone to other offices, and they just get in there and occasionally say something when it's in something that people, you know, something that the broader city cares about and to get a photo op, but really nothing happens. Like most people in city council, most people in the state legislature, who, again, it's just a lot of series of photo ops. I think they just spent too much time around Chuck Schumer.
Don't go. I remember yelling at him back in 2011 at the Puerto Rican Day Parade. I was like, stop wasting my money.
Yes. I actually asked the Puerto Rican Day Parade if I could be there as a Puerto Rican candidate. I figured, hey, they may be interested in having a Puerto Rican libertarian candidate in the parade, but they're like, no, we don't have we're nonpartisan.
What?
But, you know, they have But yet Chuck Schumer gets to be in the parade.
Yeah. And he's not even Puerto Rican. I mean, that the one time I went to the Puerto Rican Day Parade, I see Chuck Schumer and you know, the Fraternal Order of Freemasons, and I'm like, what?
Same thing happened to me. I went to go speak at the there was like a Muslim Day event, and you know, I have a friend who's a Libertarian Party who's very involved in the Muslim community over there in Staten Island. Mm-hmm. So he said, hey, come speak and address the crowd. And Chuck Schumer was supposed to address the crowd as well. And then when I got there, they said, no, we can't have you on. We don't allow political parties to talk. And we're like, wait a second, you're having Schumer. Oh, but he's a sitting office holder. But we can't have candidates. He's coming here as a senator. And I'm like, that's unfair. So I've run into that a lot last year.
Yeah. Oh, goodness. So, you know, I and this is kind of a personal issue right now. I work, my job is, you know, has a union. So I'm a union member. What and you know I'm kind of torn, because, you know, being a libertarian and, you know, the way unions operate, what are your thoughts on unions?
I mean, unions have their place in a market.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, it's an organization. People have the right to free association to form the organizations that they want. Where libertarians generally have a problem is when any party, whether it's a business, whether it's a union, whether it's anybody, advocating for laws that tip scales in their favor.
Right.
So I am all for employees of any company wanting to voluntarily get together to negotiate, because there are situations where, you know, an individual doesn't have necessarily the bargaining power to negotiate successfully to get things that may be due to them. But again, that negotiation should be done on an even playing field.
Right.
And there are a lot of times where we use politics to tip the scales in both favors, and it goes it goes both ways. It's not just the union, but also sometimes businesses. I mean, I was just talking to someone earlier today, mm-hmm. where they're trying to build a gun range in northern Jersey,
mm-hmm.
and what happens is that suddenly now there's this big push to ban gun ranges in northern Jersey. And he's pretty sure that it's actually a gun range in central Jersey that's actually pushing for that, because he doesn't want the competition. So he's now pushing a lot of the state legislatures up north, because he has clout, to try to get, you know, gun ranges banned in northern Jersey so that central Jersey gun range can keep its business.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of times the people who are behind this are oftentimes other economic interests.
Right.
But back to unions for a moment. My thing is that I think unions could be a much more powerful force if they focused on providing, like, for example, right now, if you pay your union dues, a lot of that goes to politics.
Yeah.
A lot of times it goes to Democratic politics.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to be they're not just taking union dues out of my check now. It's also like another this nonprofit organization that I never agreed to.
But yeah, and the
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
And they're going to be supporting candidates that I would never support. Like, they supported Hillary Clinton. I obviously didn't support her. not with the shirt that I was wearing that says Hillary for Prison 2016. Just
mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. This is what happens. Like, what happens is that organizations, once they feel that they can use politics to benefit themselves, that's where they focus their money on. And again, a lot of businesses do this too, where instead of focusing on how they innovate, how they improve their product, They spend the money on politics because people have gotten so accustomed to abusing government and using government to bend things in their way instead of actually just trying to win on merit. But unions, I mean, if unions focus their union dues on serving their union members, it could be transformative, okay? Because, I mean, people talk about things like parental leave and child daycare. How about instead of using the dues to go support the Democratic Party, the union uses your dues to provide services to its membership, like daycare, like parental leave, and creating programs for that, so that way you don't need to agitate the government to force the business to do it, because it's already part of your dues, and they're providing you more value, and you're not necessarily putting pressure on the employer that could cost you your job down the road. So everybody wins in that scenario, but unions don't no longer have those kind of incentives. When they first started, they did have those kind of incentives, because they were created for that. But then as politics got involved, as people got the taste of government power and how what happens when you rub the palms of Washington to use government power, all the money went there instead of actually providing value for their members.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I had to ask my union to step in with missing pay that I had. And you know, it's like...
That's good.
I felt torn. And I'm like, well... If I was missing pay and I didn't have this union, I wouldn't be getting my money back, money that's owed to me that I work for.
And that's
what
a union's for. A union should be there to represent its members in disputes with the employer. There's nothing wrong with that. There's a difference when they start asking government to force the employer to do something.
Right.
You know, but when they represent you and they sit there, they may, you know, provide you with an affordable source of legal counsel, because all the members choose to pay into the union because they choose to become a member, and you get the benefit of the resources that come with that membership. Like you get the benefit of, you know, the membership at New York Sports Club, and you get certain benefits. Mm-hmm. That's fine, because everyone's saying, okay, well, if we pool our money together voluntarily, we can provide resources that would be more expensive for us individually. That's fine. That's the way it should be done. Problem is, we have forced union membership. And again, that causes a lot of complacency in there. So why does the union, again, I think the union would do even more for you if they had to make you choose to join them. Because then they'd be like, how can I get you to join me? I got to make this so good, such a good thing to be a part of, that you choose to join me.
I mean, they, like, in order to work where I work, it was mandatory that I join the union, but you know, which as a libertarian that's wrong, but you know, the benefits that I get out of it, I don't mind, because they not only do they provide my medical and dental, they have training courses that I'm taking advantage of. I am, you know, if I needed this legal, you know, I could access legal stuff. So, you know, I am benefiting from being part of a union, but you know, I still can't forget that, you know, it was mandatory.
Yeah. Agreed. I mean, I would just like, at the end of the day, if we had a separation between politics and everything. That, you know, people always talk about separation between church and state. Right. I want to separate between union and state. I want a separation between business and state. I want to separate everything and state, because you should choose where you work. You should choose, if you're a union member, you should choose your religion. You should choose everything. And again, I do think unions provide a lot of value to their membership. Mm-hmm. I think there is a place for unions, and I have absolutely no problem with unions. I just have a problem with any institution that abuses government power.
Right. In fact, you just mentioned you want a separation of state and union, state and business. Cuomo announced, I guess a few days ago, that he wants to, in the new budget, free college.
Oh God, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, my question is, why when government is involved in everything, why everything goes completely wrong? It becomes too expensive. It becomes inefficient.
Because the government always tries to ignore the rules of economics. Mm-hmm. Here, let me go on my soapbox about education.
Go right ahead. Now, the floor is yours. We recognize the gentleman. where are you from?
I'm from Brooklyn, so I'm probably not too far from where you're at.
We recognize the gentleman from what part of Brooklyn?
Midwood.
Oh, well, yeah, far. I'm in Williamsburg.
Oh, okay, guys. Yeah, so you're
born and raised. Born and raised, yeah.
But bottom line is this. What you see happen in education is the same thing you're seeing happen in healthcare, is the same thing you're seeing happening in housing. When the government just basically says, hey, we will pay or we will subsidize the payment for something, mm-hmm. you're not changing the underlying scarcity. You're not changing the underlying amount of stuff. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like if I said, okay, well, I want everybody to have apples.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So I say, the government, I'm going to just buy everybody apples. Does that change the amount of apples that are available? No. So then what's going to happen is that eventually you're going to have less apples, so the price of apples is going to go up because everyone's buying all the apples crazily. There's just so much demand and not more apples that you're going to have an increase in the price.
Mm-hmm.
Now, yes, that also means that higher price is going to incentivize other people to make more apples. So you're going to have more apple farmers. Problem is those farmers were farming something else.
Right.
So now a farmer who used to be farming oranges is farming apples. Someone who used to be farming almonds is now farming apples. So you've just made other things more expensive because for people to provide apples, now oranges are more expensive, almonds are more expensive. So it has all these distortions in the economy. Same thing with healthcare. We subsidize healthcare. That makes healthcare prices goes up. Mm-hmm. That incentivizes people to provide healthcare services. But those are also resources that might have been distracted from elsewhere in the economy, and something else is now less developed because of it.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing for education, and again, same thing for housing. I mean, take a look at housing prices. But with education, it becomes much more pernicious because with the housing bubble, when housing prices couldn't go up anymore, well, banks could repossess the house. But what happens is that banks can't repossess your brain. So what happens when you can't pay your student loan? So really the way the student mm-hmm. loan bubble plays out, which is already happening, is just that you have a waste. Because what happens, you have someone who has very valuable skills that they've learned for 4 years, but a lot of careers requires you to get a lot of experience before you actually get paid anything reasonable,
right.
Which requires you to do internships, volunteer. But your student loans, they kick in 6 months after you graduate. So you don't have time to go take those internships, go get that experience. So you're just going to go grab the first job you can get.
Mm-hmm.
So you have so many different college graduates right now graduating and not taking all those skills that they learned 4 years, and they're just not being used. So basically it becomes this just huge burden, and you're wasting the resource, this human capital that was invested in, but now can't be put to its proper use because we made it so easy to get loans, which ended up over time pushing up the prices of tuition. Going back to that whole Apple analogy, when
right.
people buy something, when you make it easy for people to buy something, it's just going to make it more scarce, push up the price. And then again, there's all those other distortions. So there's a lot more to it. And for anyone who's listening, I have done many videos on the subject,
mm-hmm.
which you can check out all my videos over there at youtube.com/AlexMerced.
So, two questions. First one was, I saw this documentary, I don't know if you heard of it, called The College Deception.
No, I actually haven't.
Yeah, it's from a now defunct, think tank. But they, the way they explained it was, because by law, colleges can't accept people who received like Pell Grants or federal grants unless they get more students that are paying with cash or not using a federal loan or stuff like that. That's why tuition keeps rising higher and higher, because, you know, in order to keep up with, I guess, inflation or you know, be able to pay people, you know, to keep with the
okay, so but the bottom line is to keep up, to be able to get the subsidy from the government, they have to be able to receive X cash from cash payers.
Yes.
So basically, as the subsidy increases, they have to increase the amount of cash they're getting on the side.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
So
okay, yeah, I wasn't quite familiar with that, but that definitely would make sense.
Yeah. So do you believe that that's what's causing like the scarcity of like engineers and doctors, tech professionals, is what it's like an article that I read that Trump is not addressing that there's a shortage of tech workers for these jobs that are growing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's because you've distorted market signals. Like, let's imagine there's a world where the government wasn't involved in the education market. What would happen? you would have to go get a loan from a bank. Mm-hmm. And again, this is absent of any government loan subsidies that prevent the bank from losing money. So the bank could lose money if you don't pay them back.
Right.
So then the bank is going to care what program you're into. So the so even though a young kid at the age of 18 probably doesn't know very well what the best choice is mm-hmm. or what they want to do and whatnot. I mean, I didn't quite understand. I mean, I was a popular culture studies major. I mean, I enjoyed what I learned, but I work in finance now.
Right.
But the bottom line is that bank will have an interest in doing the research to find out what are sort of the next big career, big fields of study, and say, hey, if you want a loan, you need to study this because we need to make sure that you can afford to pay us back.
Right.
So then what will happen is that kids will have to either make a choice, you know, be like, okay, well, if I want a loan to go to this school, I need to take this program. But then a new effect will happen. Colleges are going to be like, well, I still would like to offer a cultural studies program, but the problem is kids can't get the loan to pay the same tuition as the law program. So maybe instead of charging everybody the same price, how about maybe we charge a different price for the cultural studies program? Mm-hmm. Why should you be paying the same amount for a cultural studies degree than for a law degree? One's going to give you a very different income than the other. It's like paying the same thing for a Big Mac as I do for a double cheeseburger. Mm-hmm. That wouldn't make any sense. So then what happens is that you'll actually have universities will have an incentive to create pricing based on outcomes. So then someone who wants a cultural studies degree can get it, but they're not going to have to go into $100,000 in debt to get it. It'll be priced affordable enough because of the income it generates, and then that kid won't be in so much debt that if they're not happy with it, they can go back and go get another degree. They're not stuck with $100,000 in debt because they chose the wrong degree because they didn't know better when they were 18. So the idea is there would be actually be more incentives for people to evaluate decisions, and there wouldn't be such a high penalty for making the wrong decision, which would make it easier for people to shift gears and actually supply those engineers. But also at the same time, the more we tax that, and like right now what happens, things like the minimum wage increases and whatnot, that also hurts because people are all upset about inequality. But sometimes those inequalities, some reasons why inequality happens are bad, some reasons why inequality happens are good. A good reason, so for example, if there is a scarce amount of engineers should be making a load of money, which they do, which means there's going to be inequality between the engineer and somebody else. Mm-hmm. But that's a good thing because that inequality creates an incentive to become an engineer to satisfy that demand, that need for more engineers.
Right.
Because of the amount of time it's going to take me to learn that. So you want those kind of inequalities to exist. You want those premiums for satisfying things that the economy needs to exist. Mm-hmm. But if you sit there and say, well, I got to pay people this much, and you start limiting or narrowing that inequality between the engineer and everybody else, then that incentive, that extra benefit for being the engineer is not there, and you diminish the incentive to do that.
Right. So I don't got enough time with you, but I did my research, but what does a comptroller do?
Ah, yes. Okay, the comptroller is a position that I don't think enough people care about. But it really does play an important role, and the person we have now really doesn't have the right experience to really be satisfying that role, mm-hmm. which shows in the results. But basically, the comptroller has three main responsibilities. The first one is to audit the government. For example, let's pretend I'm comptroller. I would be auditing the different programs. I'd be auditing NYCHA. I'd be auditing all of de Blasio's different programs, mm-hmm. not because I'm just to say, okay, this is the policy. Here's how money's being spent. And the idea is that I'm supposed to identify whether it's being spent well and can the policy be done better. So essentially the comptroller is a watchdog. They're there to they're the watchdog for the taxpayer to make sure the taxpayer money is being spent wisely and not being wasted. Mm-hmm. The second job they have is that New York has to borrow money. All municipalities have to issue bonds to finance their day-to-day expenses. Mm-hmm. So it's basically they're taking out a loan. Now, the comptroller works with investment banks to help get those loans. So you would want someone who understands interest rates and understands financing, which I do since I've been working in finance for the last decade, to kind of be in that space mm-hmm. to help New York get the best financing possible. Because, again, that means taxpayer dollars and having to pay back those loans.
Yeah.
So if I could save you a percentage points of interest because I'm asking the right questions and talking to the right people, well, that could save you hundreds of thousands of dollars in taxpayer money in the long run.
Yeah, let me interrupt you real quick when it comes to bonds, because I'm kind of interested. Wouldn't it be better for New York City to directly sell bonds to the people. Like, let's say, you know, I go into City Hall and I'm like, I want to buy New York City debt to be...
Well, you know, here's the problem. Mm-hmm. The problem is municipal bonds, they generally have very, very low interest rates. Mm-hmm. The reason for that is because they're exempt from federal taxation. So very high income investors with very high tax brackets, they like them because they end up making them more money after taxes. But for like me and you in a lower tax bracket, we'd be better off buying like a GE or like a GM corporate bond. It's not going to be making us enough money to be worth our time because we're in such a lower tax bracket. Mm. So most people really just wouldn't – they'd be better – there'd be better investments for most people. It wouldn't be suitable for most people in New York City. Mm-hmm. It would only be suitable for the most highest net worth investors, and those investors are probably the investors who are already buying them.
Right. Okay. So you would think like a position like this – I mean, this is a question that I had. Why is this position so politicized? Like, why does it matter if someone's a Democrat or a Republican or a
Libertarian? The third power of the comptroller is the most important one. Mm-hmm. What it is is that the pensions of the workers of New York City, how they get invested, has a lot to do with who's the comptroller. Okay.
Okay.
So that, and then generally that means a lot of the public sector unions, and the public sector unions, again, they tend to lean Democratic. So that's part of the reason that makes it so political. Because I mean, these are the people with the keys. But the problem is the people like Scott Stringer who are in charge, they don't understand this enough to ask the right questions. Mm-hmm. So for example, right now, let me actually bring up the numbers. I have the numbers right here on my phone, as far as how much money, because what happens is that if the pension fund, the money where all the pension work that all the city workers are going to get their retirements from, mm-hmm. if that fund doesn't make enough money, they're not going to get paid their retirement. So what happens if they don't make enough money, what's going to happen is that the New York City has to make what's called a catch-up contribution, which means we have to pay out even more taxpayer money to get that done. Now, let's see here. Where did I put this? I have the numbers around here somewhere, mm-hmm. but the bottom line is these catch-up contributions are like hundreds of millions of dollars. Okay, basically over the next, between now and I think 2021, you're looking at $1 billion, not of normal pension contributions, of catch-up contributions, because the pension funds have not performed. Mm-hmm. Now, why have they not performed? Because we have an assumed rate of return of 7%. So basically, when we calculate how much money we got to put in the fund, we assume that every year that fund's going to make 7%. Which is actually a lot. Okay, that's the reason why it's 7% is because in the 80s you had much higher interest rates. So there were interest rates were like you could get 7 and 8% in your savings account. So using 7 to 8% for your pension fund made sense back in those days because that was relatively risk free when you had higher interest rates in a more inflationary environment. But we don't have that anymore. You're at 0% interest rates right now. So to get 7% requires you to take a lot of risk, which is really hard to do for a lot of pension funds.
Right.
That's the reason why they were so heavily loaded with mortgage-backed securities that led them to lose so much money in 2008. So you have all these funds, people's retirement money, the money that they depend on when they retire someday is chasing too much risk. That's why what I want to do is I want to start the conversation about lowering that rate to something like 3 or 4%. Now, what does that means two things. One, that means the annual contribution that has to be put into the pension fund will be bigger. But I do think the taxpayer will save money in the long run because you won't be chasing as much risk, which means the portfolio will be more stable, which means you won't have hits like 2008. Mm-hmm. And plus, it'll more predictably hit its benchmark, which means you won't have catch-up contributions. So basically, we say 7%, which means we have to put less money every year, but we end up putting more anyways because we're not hitting 7%. So I'd rather actually just have a rate that we can hit. So that way, we're not caught off guard with $1 billion worth of catch-up contributions. Mm. But see, these are the things that Scott Stringer wouldn't know to ask because he doesn't know this stuff because he's not a finance guy. He's a politician. He was the borough president of Manhattan before he was a comptroller. He doesn't have the financial background to be – he has financial people around him. But mm-hmm. again, you need – the person at the top has to know what to ask the people around him in order to get things done.
So how did he get this? How did he? Why did he go for a job that he wasn't qualified for?
Because he wants to be mayor. Like, that's been all the big deal this year. Like, is Scott Stringer going to run for mayor?
Is he even running yet? Has he?
He hasn't announced yet, because he might not announce, because it might not, he might, again, when you take a look at the polls, it might turn out that when he does his research, that it may not be a good time for him to run against de Blasio. And that the polls may be too much in favor of de Blasio for him to risk his seat of the comptroller. But the thing is that, I mean, in 2015, the pension funds only returned 3.5%. That's half the 7% they're required. You know, so again, it'd make much more sense to be at that 3-4% from the get-go as our benchmark. But no one's talking about it. And there's a lot of people who work for the City of New York, and they should be caring. And those are mainly union labor who should be caring how these pension funds are taken care of. And that there you have somebody in office who does care that these things are taken care of.
So okay, final question. Who do you like for mayor?
Whoever the Libertarian candidates are. I have an idea who the candidates are, which one it will be. I don't know, but whoever is the Libertarian Party candidate will have my support. Right now it looks like it's going to be me for comptroller. It's going to be Devin Balkin, who's awesome, for public advocate. Okay. Very interesting guy. He knows a lot about technology and wants to use his technological know-how to make New York City more efficient, to save taxpayers money. So people should look into him. His website is probably up by now. And then for borough president of Manhattan, we have my ex-campaign manager, who just had his baby a couple days ago, a couple days ago. And he's running on a solid platform of getting rid of the borough presidency, which is a useless position that just wastes taxpayers' money.
Right.
So they literally do nothing.
Okay, so is David Yalkin or Balkin?
B-A-L-K-I-N-D. Balkin.
B-A-L?
Yep, so Devin... B-A-L K-I-N-D.
Okay.
And his first name's Devin.
K-I-L. Okay. Just get
Yep. And then borough president is my ex-campaign manager, Brian Waddell. And if you want, I can get them in touch with you if you'd like to have them on the show.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic. You know, the more, like, you know, hell, get a libertarian for dog catcher, even though there's no such...
At least not here in New York City. I don't think there's a dog catcher office. We have a lot. There's a lot of offices. There's some really cool candidates for city council. There's a couple of them. There's a couple of candidates I really like. And also the other person everyone needs to know about is Larry Sharp. He's more than likely, pretty much I would say 99% chance, he'll be running for governor of New York next year for 2018. And if you have not heard Larry Sharp talk, he is the most exciting libertarian voice in libertarianism right now by far. So people need to and if you didn't watch the debate last year, the vice presidential debate at the Libertarian National Convention, watching him and William Weld kind of go back and forth was pretty amazing.
Wait, he used to be a professional wrestler?
No. Larry Sharp is – that's a different Larry Sharp.
Oh.
Yes. I always forget that there's that Larry Sharp.
Oh, here it is.
It's the same spelling. It's just a different guy.
Found him.
So if you want to find him, it's Facebook. His Facebook page is Larry Sharp, Libertarian. And then my Facebook page is Alex Merced - Libertarian Party.
So anyways, Alex, thank you for coming on. You are welcome to come on anytime you want. You know, just like, hey, Louie – come on, I need to come on, I need to like say some stuff. You are more than welcome to come back on. And you got my vote.
Thank you.
You got my vote. You better win. we need to drain the swamp over here.
We are working hard at the Libertarian Party. We have a lot of work to do here in New York. Again, after 2018, if we can win that ballot access, it will change the game, and we can start really putting up some points on the board here in New York.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to be trying my hard to get the word out about the pension fund stuff and all this stuff, because a lot of people don't realize a lot of these financial aspects of running a city. And I think there's a really strong case for a libertarian in a position like comptroller, because as comptroller, I don't get to set minimum wage. Mm-hmm. I don't get to set taxes. So if you disagree with a libertarian on those aspects on policy, it doesn't mean you can't vote for them for comptroller, because all a comptroller is a watchdog. And what you want is someone who who deeply, deeply cares about protecting tax dollars and pension dollars. Like, the slogan for my campaign is, it's your taxes, it's your pension, it's your life, because I'm here to protect your life, because those dollars matter. Because those dollars are your retirement, your tax dollars are the time that you spent at work that you could have been spending with your kids, with your family, in your community. So someone needs to be out there protecting them.
Exactly. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Alex. And we got to do that. I got to do this one more time. By state law.
No ways.
Got to do this. Thank you. I'd like to thank everyone for listening today. Please smash that like button. And also, please follow Alex at Alex Merced on the Twitter. That's AlexMerced. Check him out, alexmerced.com. Follow him if you're in New York City or know any New Yorkers. Tell your family, friends, vote. Vote early, vote often, like Vermin Supreme would say.
Vermin.
I love him.
Yeah, actually, he endorsed me for U.S. Senate.
Oh,
I actually have that on video.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yep, that was awesome.
So yeah, and you also do your own podcast, the Alex Merced Cast.
One of six podcasts that I do. So I do the Alex Merced Cast about libertarian politics. I do Breaking Progressives, where I break down left-wing narratives every week. I do Economics Why Not, which is about economics.
Mm-hmm.
I do Libertarian Comments, which is just really a lot of my old recordings from 2008, 2009, 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And I also do a podcast about podcasting and logging tips and tricks. Ah. So go on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, subscribe to all of them, and please leave them positive reviews.
Alrighty then. So yeah, you can also follow me at LouisB1 on Twitter. Also on Gab. You should get on Gab. Gab is also at LouisB1 because Twitter is dying. Follow me on iHeartRadio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and Stitcher. And also, of course, Spreaker.com. This has been the Crash Out Radio Show. And as always, from my house to your house. Mahalo. And oops.